speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? It's not fair. Throw it away. All right? All right!
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord. It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Hey, wait, there's something weird here.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
Someone is coming back to Elm Street. He is not friendly. He is not patient. And he is not a welcome visitor. Something terribly special for the new kid on the block.
It's starting to happen again.
Dad! You're in trouble. You've had some scary dreams, okay? Help!
Daddy can't help you now.
There's something inside
of you. Fight him! You're not afraid of him. He doesn't even exist.
Freddy Krueger is back on Elm Street.
This is a special episode of the Really Awful Movies Podcast, number 95, A Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge. Since sleep deprivation and coffee are recurring themes in the Nightmare series, we thought we'd record this one at a coffee shop in our neighborhood. Unfortunately, we had some issues with the recording. We apologize for the occasional sound problems. It does sound better as you go along. Thanks for listening.
From Men at Coffee in downtown Toronto, episode 95. Nightmare on Elm Street, Part 2, Freddy's Revenge. Nightmare on Elm Street, the house that Freddy built, New Line Cinemas. What did this addition do to the franchise, so to speak?
Well, it's interesting, because, I mean, ostensibly, they should have derailed the franchise, considering it was so wildly divergent from the first. In a lot of ways, I mean, this film fails on so many levels. On the other hand, there's a few things to commend about it. This is a genre that is known for turning out sequel after sequel. And when you look at franchise films, such as, you know, your Halloweens, your Friday 13s, your Nightmares, what have you, sequels are just as...
It is integral to
the legacy
development
of the franchise as the original. Now, with Nightmare 2, this is a very interesting thing, because Nightmare 1 was a cultural juggernaut. I mean, this thing came out in 1984 at the lowest of expectations. You mentioned that New Line Cinemas was a house that Freddy built, and it was. This was a studio that was completely insolvent. When they had a chance on a young filmmaker named Wes Craven, and he had this idea, this killer that stalks in your dreams and kills you, Freddy Krueger, they had no idea that it would be as successful as it was, and it was successful. So, when the opening weekend grosses for that movie came out, right away they greenlit a sequel. And they wanted that sequel out as soon as possible. Nightmare came out in 1984. This one was released in 1985. Now, there was a bit of a problem. And that problem was Wes Craven.
That is a bit of a problem, yeah.
Well, I mean...
The fact that his successor held the first one in contempt.
And I wouldn't say contempt, but I mean, the reality is that when Wes Craven sold New Line the rights to Freddy Krueger, he had no intention of this becoming a franchise. He basically wanted Nightmare to be a standalone movie. He wanted to end conclusively, not ambiguously. He wanted the ending to be a sort of a happy ending. Freddy's vanquished, everybody rides off into the sunset, and that's the end of that. But New Line wanted to cash in. So whether Wes was involved or not, they were going to make a sequel. And they approached a director by the name of Jack Sholder, who had worked with New Line in the past. Now, Jack Sholder has gone on record as saying that he really is not a fan of the first movie, so as a result, he felt no compunction to follow the rules of the first movie, the rules that Wes Craven set out so indelibly in the first movie. So what we're left with is a sequel that is derided by many for two reasons. One, because it diverges so greatly sharply from the first, and the other because of a bit of subtext that it really turned out to be text, but we'll talk about a bit of that in a moment or two. Yeah, so we have a sequel which has no principles from the first movie returning, other than the fact that the same
that should give you pause
it
immediately right there.
Yeah, but we have no Craven, we have no Heather Langenkamp, who was, you know, survived the original.
You know, John Saxon.
No John Saxon. Langenkamp was the protagonist of the first one.
I'm just thinking, John Saxon in the first movie, he approached Wes Craven and he held two toupees in his hand. He said, "Which one should I go with?" You know, and he said, "Okay, go with this one." But it's just, it's just something so sad and so funny about that. And the poor guy, he's a great actor.
I love John Saxon.
He's amazing. Enter the Dragon, litany of B-movie, Italian crime, mafia, rip-off movies. He's excellent. But the fact that he would just come in and say, which one would you rather go with? There's something so sad about that.
That's what a director does. I mean, he's got to make those executive decisions.
It's true.
So good for him. He's picking good toupee for Mr. Saxon.
Yeah, fair enough.
Anyway, when I said no principles were turned, I almost mean that literally, because they didn't even want Robert Englund back. They did want him back, but Robert Englund's agent said, "Hey, look, man, you made a shit ton of money with the first one, so my client needs a raise for the second one." They said, "You know what? We're working on low budget here."
Which is extremely unfair to him, who, it could be argued, created the character out of whole cloth, because he was given very little direction. He just took all these different influences, whether you're James Cagney or you're Nosferatu, and he just crafted his own character on which the whole franchise depends. So okay, good on them for finally ponying up the dope.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, there's a tradition like it, because I mean, when you look at Friday 13th, with the exception of Kane Hodder, who appeared in, I'd say, four or five Fridays in a row, albeit the worst in the franchise.
And we're not saying this because he refused to do an interview with us. Okay, we are saying
that. We are saying that, yeah. But every Friday movie had a different actor under the mask. And the fact is, because all you needed was a big, burly stuntman under the mask, you know, walk methodically, slowly, with a bit of threatening gait, and portray
an unstoppable, indefatigable, psychopath.
And when it comes to Freddy Krueger, because he's so verbose, and because his visage is not hit by a mask, I mean, you really cannot interchange him with any other actor. And I mean, that has been proven with the Nightmare remake. Oh, I don't want to speak about that one. When England's agent demanded a pay raise for his client, they balked. They said no. And they actually start filming this thing with a different actor, some sort of extra. And then they realize, you know what, this guy's walking like Frankenstein. He doesn't have the gait. So they pony up the dough, and we got England back. But other than that, I mean, there's so much about this movie that takes what was established, a template that was established in Nightmare 1, and throws it out the window.
Yeah.
Freddy Krueger, what makes him so indelibly scary is this is a character that can attack you when you're most vulnerable. And when is that? When you're sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
When you're unconscious of the world. When you're in your dreams, in your subconscious. He's in there playing around in your subconscious. Now, that's an incredible conceit for a horror movie antagonist. With Nightmare 2, they took that and sort of flipped around, and they allowed Freddy Krueger to have power in the real world, to kill in the real world, completely throwing...
abnegating the weapon in the first
movie. Yeah, because, I mean, in the first movie, you know, the way to vanquish Freddy was to bring him into the real world. He only had power in the dream world. So when Nancy took it upon herself to vanquish Freddy, she had to pull him out into the real world where he lost all his power. Well, in this movie, which is very tangentially related to the first, the only thing that really connects the first to the second is
the house and a diary.
A house and a diary, yeah. Exactly. Freddy Krueger is killing in the real world. Not only is he killing in the real world, but apparently he needs some sort of conduit in the land of the living in order to have some power. And this conduit is a young teenager by the name of Jesse, a male. Mm-hmm. Which again is a little bit different, because in horror it's always the female who is faced with the killer, you know, the final girl. That's a conceit that's been used over and over again to great success. Mark Patton, who played Jesse, considers himself a final girl.
And a scream queen.
And a scream queen. As years have gone on, the one thing that this movie has, fans and detractors alike will say, is that Nightmare 2 has a lot of, let's just say, homoerotic subtext. Now, the reality is, this is not subtext. This is text. This is a very homoerotic movie. It has been called the gayest horror movie ever made by BuzzFeed, by Mark Patton himself. He's an openly gay actor. And this movie has tons of gay subtext. Does that take away from the film? Does that enhance the film? I would say it kind of does. Well, neither or both. I mean, it's a very, like I said, like this is a very interesting movie. I will maintain that this is a terrible Nightmare on Elm Street movie, but it's not a bad age teen slasher.
It happened to be made, what, less than a year after, and you always have to, when you're doing one of these films, is to divorce yourself from any sort of prejudice you might have from having watched the original. Everything is a separate entity, and the director said he went into it saying he did not like the first one, so we're going to accept this as if it's its own separate entity. This one, the only ties are, again, as you mentioned, however tenuous, the house on Elm Street,
the house in maybe the Springwood, Ohio. Yeah,
Springwood, Ohio, the most, arguably one of the most iconic abodes in the history of the horror pantheon.
Well, that,
other than maybe
Laurie's,
the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
I was going to say Laurie Strode's, the house
in Haddonfield, Illinois. And like, yeah. And other than that, the connection with the diary that Jesse finds of Heather Langenkamp's character. So he is a teen whose family has purchased this house, which has been on the market for 5 years.
Yeah, which is
because interesting. Because it's,
the timeline is a bit weird, because, I mean, when you consider the fact that the first movie came out in 84 and ostensibly took place in 84, and then after the horrific events of the first movie, this one takes place 5 years hence. I mean, that's when they purchased the home. It was on the market 5 years. This took place in 89, 90? Doesn't look it. I mean, no. The fashions are quite conspicuously 1985.
For sure. And it makes you wonder if the thing didn't sell in 1 to 2 years. I'm no real estate agent, but at a certain point, you'd figure, okay, you're going to drop the price where someone's going to buy it, and where its reputation will be just sort of forgotten about. And, you know,
we can sort of get into the whole, like, logistics in the sense, like, I mean, okay, well, that's why Clue Gallagher, I mean, this guy was in Return of the Living Dead. He's the paternal figure. He bought the house. He's the father of Jesse. He's got a wife. He's got a young daughter. Now, he purchased a house. It was steel. It was on the market for 5 years. The whole logistics was all like, did all the neighbors move away? Was there no, like, was there no due diligence done? Like, yeah. You know, this was a house where the infamous Springwood slasher, child molester, what have you. I mean, you know.
Yeah, 5 years is a long time, you know. At a certain point, you'd figure, okay, you know, its reputation would have been
diminished?
Diluted and diminished. Yeah, for sure.
I don't know, man. The Tate LaBianca house is still pretty...
Yeah, who was it? I don't know who bought it after the singer from Nine Inch Nails. But, the Manson mansion is currently inhabited. Mm-hmm. So I'd be happy to put in an offer to any sort of house where any nefarious, you know, doings have taken place. I'm fine with that. Then again, you're talking to someone who's got no money whatsoever. But and here we go. We've got, you know, this teen who's tenuously tied to the first film via a diary. He's experiencing these nightmares.
Mm-hmm. But it's different because it's unlike the first movie where, you know, you're dreaming of Freddy Krueger and you're in mortal peril in the sense that if Freddy kills you in your dream, you are dead in real life. This is a different sort of nightmare in the sense that he's dreaming about Freddy and he's waking up screaming, and when he screams, it's effeminate.
Yeah.
Shoulder himself said there was a very strong feminine component to that actor. He's waking up not afraid of the fact that he almost perished in his dream, but the fact that he's donning the glove of Freddy Krueger.
As well as a pair of tidy whities.
That too, yes. So, I mean, the whole conceit of this movie is that Freddy somehow needs this teen, this Jesse character, to be his conduit into the land of the living, into the real world where he can kill. And Jesse is, I mean, it's interesting because horror movies oftentimes look to the outsider. Jesse is an outsider in many ways. I mean, forget about the fact that Mark Patton is now an openly gay actor, Hollywood, who at the time is closeted, but he was, I don't want to say he was sort of obviously gay, but I mean, again, like Schilder said, there was something feminine about that actor. That makes him an outsider, but what also makes him an outsider is a new kid in town. He's new in this, in this neighborhood, he's new in Springwood, he's got to go to school, he's got to make friends, and like most new kids, he's finding a tough time making friends. So he's on the baseball diamond, he's playing a game of baseball, ostensibly during gym class, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, and his obviously his focus is elsewhere, because this is not the focus of his interest by any means. He's basically been compelled, cajoled into doing this. He doesn't want to do this. A lot of us didn't want to do gym class, let's be honest. But him, for different reasons, his head is in the clouds. He gets beamed by a line drive. The ball nails him in the noggin. This raises the hackles of his teammates who go, you know, what are you doing, man? You gotta catch this ball. You gotta help us win the game. And there's an alpha male named Grady.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets into his face and says, you know, what the hell are you doing, man? You gotta keep your head in the game. And he proceeds to pants Jesse and get involved in this extremely homoerotic wrestling match on the turf, which is interrupted by the gym coach
Schneider,
who, you know, separates the two, and then when, you know, he lambastes them and reprimands them and says, okay, you guys give me, you know, what is it when you're run afoul of your gym teacher, you do push-ups.
Mm.
So he gets the two to do a bunch of push-ups in the middle of the baseball diamond. The two of them are begrudgingly doing this. He says, you know, Grady says to him, to Jesse, so, you know, this Schneider fellow is, he's just doing this to get his rocks off. The interests lie in the leather scene and the local bar scene. He's really a gay guy.
Well, he doesn't want to say he's a gay guy, but what he says is that he hangs
explicitly
around queer,
yeah.
S&M mm-hmm. joints downtown, which is, again, kind of strange because, I mean, this is Springwood, Ohio, mm-hmm. right? This is not San Francisco, Los Angeles, California, New York City, what have you. I wonder, is there even a downtown in Springwood, Ohio? I don't even know, but hey, there's a queer S&M joint downtown. Interestingly enough, I mean, you would think that Grady and Jesse would be antagonists throughout the movie,
yeah.
but they sort of form this friendship, I guess, through your enemy and my friend. Yeah, they end up becoming friends. And another thing about Schneider is he also likes to send his young charges to the showers.
Yes.
And this will come to place later.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that, I mean, this movie is rife with subtext in terms of a lot of people read this movie as a young closeted man coming to grips with his sexuality, he does have a girlfriend. And his girlfriend is Lisa.
Yes.
You sort of made a little lie.
No, I'm just saying that would be a beard in common parlance.
Well, possibly.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's evidence for that later. Now, it's interesting because, you know, I watched the documentary Never Sleep Again, The Elm Street Legacy, where they basically talk about every single Elm Street movie, including this one. They give her a thrift in this one. They only give it about 20 minutes in like a 7-hour documentary. However, one thing they mentioned about Lisa was the only reason they cast her was because she looked exactly like Meryl Streep, complete Meryl Streep doppelganger.
Could she act like Meryl Streep?
Nah. I don't think so. And, I mean, the reality is that her and Jesse don't have the greatest of chemistry. Mark Patton and the actress business don't have the greatest chemistry, but what have you. I mean, did
Eyes Wide Shut level of chemistry.
Did Glenn and, you know, Johnny Depp and Heather Langenkamp have chemistry?
Yeah, a little bit.
You think so?
Yeah. A little bit, yeah.
Well, it's interesting, too, because another reason why they cast Patton in the role was because Schulder thought that because he had this sort of feminine quality to him, he would be somewhat akin to Johnny Depp, who, I mean, as much of a heartthrob as Johnny Depp is, he is...
You would never mistake for being a
McQueen.
Guy. Oh, okay.
That's what
yeah.
I'm trying to say. Like, he's not the manliest of men. Mm-hmm. He's not an alpha male. He's got a bit of androgyny to him, right?
Yeah.
Whereas Patton, I think, had a bit more going on. He's a little bit of androgyny.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's neither here nor there for the time being. What makes this movie very different than Nightmare on Elm Street, the first, is the fact that, for some reason, Freddy Krueger has this fixation on Jesse. He needs to possess this young man, and he needs him to be his conduit to killing young teenagers down Elm Street. And, you know, I mean, a very famous line is, I need you, Jesse. You've got the body. I've got the brain.
Mic drop. Not much left to the imagination there. Yeah, he does have the body. When Jesse is plagued by these nightmares, again, references the first film where he is afraid of sleep. And he has a little coffee maker in his bedroom, or is it the kitchen? I forget which, but he's just basically guzzling Java. And apparently, I guess from the original nightmare, that Wes Craven was influenced by people who died in the middle of sleep, who were afraid of going to sleep. And so this conceit is carried on into this one, although I would say not as convincingly. He is plagued by nightmares similar to what Heather Langenkamp experienced in The Class, where a classmate is reading Julius Caesar and she is tormented by this vision of a body in
plastic body bag.
In a body bag, which is one of the iconic, I would argue, scenes from the, excuse me, that was the door here, iconic scenes from the first one. In this one, he is plagued by nightmares of a snake, and you don't need to be Carl Jung to determine, you know, what the snake would
represent.
Yeah. And it is constricting him by the neck. Mm-hmm. And this could be read as, you know, a guy who's struggling to come to terms with his sexuality. This is a snake. This is maybe a phallic symbol in the middle of his class. It's constricting him, and he wakes up in a cold sweat, and everyone is laughing at him.
Well, all this guy does is keep waking up in a cold sweat throughout the entire movie. I mean,
at least he wasn't in his tidy whities in class.
True. But I mean, there is a bit of a difference. Whereas Langenkamp and the other characters in the Nightmare franchise were afraid to go to sleep for want of waking up alive because Freddy would kill them in their dream. He's afraid of going to sleep because he's afraid of being possessed by Freddy. And the few times that he would fall asleep, he would wake up with a Freddy glove affixed to his hand, and he would let out this blood curdling shriek. And you know, so again, if you have this conceit of Freddy needing Jesse, of all people, to be his conduit to the land of the living, he actually wants, and this is a quote from Freddy Krueger in the movie, "Kill for me, Jesse. Kill for me." Now, talk about Freudian symbolism. You know, at one point, Jesse wakes up in another one of his cold sweats, and he wanders out into the cold, dark night, let's say, and with his shirt open, dripping in sweat, he ends up in one of these S&M leather bars downtown. Mm-hmm. And this is not a dream, this is reality.
No.
And he stalls up to the bar and he orders a beer.
And inexplicably he's served, despite the drinking age in the U.S. being 21.
Then and now, yeah. This kid is obviously 16, 17. Yeah. So Jesse's there and all of a sudden a hand reaches out, grabs him on the shoulder, and it's good old Cole Schneider. Yeah, for some reason, Schneider decides to punch him right then and there. And Schneider is dressed up in his finest SM finery,
leather
vest,
yeah,
studs, etc. He takes Jesse back to the school, makes him run a bunch of laps, and then says, "Hey, buddy, hit the showers." So while Jesse is taking a shower, Schneider's in his office, and Freddy makes his presence known. Not versus Jesse, but versus Schneider.
Mm-hmm.
And poor Schneider, all of a sudden, it's like a game of bombardment in The Simpsons. I mean, the guy is beset upon by dozens of balls.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy
like
is being
dodgeball,
balled to death.
Yeah.
Okay, and this is a character that has been established as having proclivities that are non-normative, per se.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
A little bit AC/DC, let's say.
Yeah.
You know, and he's being balled to death. And if that's not enough, he then gets these jump ropes, get affixed to him,
and drag him into the shower.
Carried into the shower, where he's trussed up. An unseen hand rips off his clothing. He's now bare-ass naked. Now, you know, slasher movies in the 80s were
replete with female nudity. Yeah.
That was the whole thing, is that, you know, you want to see your blood, you want to see your boobs, and you want to see your beasts. I guess I mean monsters.
Yeah.
There is nudity in this one, but it's of the male variety. So we have this Cole Schneider, and this is already the second bare male ass we've seen this movie, and he's trussed up, and a towel just comes out of nowhere and flicks him on the butt.
Yeah.
And then Freddy slashes him to death. Now, Jesse, of course, is beside himself because he feels complicit in these murders. Luckily, he has a confidant in Lisa, and she's starting to believe him because, you know, she read the diaries, but it's just strange. It's different. Another thing we didn't mention is but we're going to mention now, is the immolating bird. What a scene that was.
Yeah, well, I guess to underscore just how, I don't know, charged with evil the Elm Street house is, they have a pet
parakeet.
And this parakeet dive bombs, on the father and wounds him. And
the house, apparently, I mean, Jesse is always saying it's too hot, and it's a common complaint. This house is hot. It's like an oven in here. And when Clue Gallagher goes and checks the thermostat, it's 98 degrees. Mm-hmm. Then they go and open up the birdcage.
The birdcage,
and
yeah.
This fucking parakeet flies out, and is just itching. And yeah, mm-hmm. As you said before, he dive bombed the father. And interestingly enough, I mean, that was poor Gallagher has a scar to this day from that stupid parakeet. But anyhow,
and maybe it was a nod to the birdcage. To continue the gay subtext, I don't know. No, but it was actually a nod to Hitchcock's The Bird.
It was. I mean, that's why they include that scene, which mm-hmm. At this point, I mean, Stolter and most other people involved in the movie say he was absolutely goofy.
Insane.
And we completely regret putting that in the movie. However, this parakeet just bursts into flames, and that's that. All of this is leading to a pool party. Lisa, Jesse's girlfriend,
Paramore, yeah.
29 quotes, is having a pool party. And all the kids are going to be there, all the cool kids. At this party, Jesse is there, and he's I guess you would say he's a bit of a party pooper. He's not exactly happy to be there. It's because his mind is basically preoccupied with the death of Schneider and all the different shit that's been going on in his life. And Lisa suggests, hey, come into the cabana with me and let's talk. Things get a little hot and heavy.
Yeah.
Before you know it, they're making out. Next thing you know, they're about to engage in a little bit of extracurricular
panky-panky. Yeah.
But in the midst of it all, a tongue
protrudes from his mouth. Yeah. And this one could read in modern eyes as a man who's struggling, a young man who's struggling with his sexuality. And needing, I would argue, any excuse to get out of this situation, which is something just anathema to him that he can't feel comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
And, but that was, I feel, one of the most frightening scenes, because sex, among teens, whatever, your first initial sexual experiences are fraught with tension and peril. And we've all been there, right? You always remember your first.
Oh, of course, yeah. I'd like to forget it, actually. But,
Likewise. And any excuse almost to get out of there if you can't prove that you're some sort of alpha male Lothario. And he seems out of his element here, obviously.
Yeah.
And this is because when he's experiencing the nightmares that have plagued him for months, he actually find solace with his friend Grady.
Well, that's the whole thing. I mean, Grady, interestingly enough, early in the movie, Grady says, so, tell me about, I forget, what's her name?
Lisa?
Lisa? Well, yeah, Lisa, sorry.
Who knows?
Tell me about Lisa. Are you mounting her nightly? Oh, shut up, Grady.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, shut up, yeah.
We can assume that this was his first, visit to the pleasure dome, so to speak.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, he sees this demonic tongue, which is like Freddy's tongue, and you would think that he would, after having this fright, take solace in the arms of his girlfriend. Instead, he makes haste to Grady's room. Now, Grady's not at the party because he was grounded, and he's sleeping. Jesse barges into his bedroom and says, hey, man, I need to stay with you. And this is where the homoerotic subtext becomes very, very textual.
Yeah, if it wasn't obviously apparent with Grady just being nude from the waist up with his chiseled physique in his bedroom here
you have, here you have Jesse saying something like, I'm all mixed up, and something's trying to get inside my body, And then Grady goes, somebody's going to try and get inside your body? You want to sleep with me?
Yeah.
Another line he says is,
You have a girl waiting for you in cabana.
Yeah.
You want to be here with me. You should be down there boffing her.
Exactly. And, this does lead to one of the greatest set pieces in the entire movie.
Yes.
Because throughout the entire movie, I mean, you have Freddy trying to
use Jesse as a conduit to the real world, or the conscious world. And the emerges through his chest, and almost like the chest bursting scene in Alien, he emerges from his stomach and just takes over Jesse's persona and embodies him fully in order to murder Grady.
And Jesse goes, it's starting to happen again, and Freddy comes out, and it's just an incredible
tour
de force
of
practical effects. Kudos to Kevin Yeager did the effects for this one. Amazing. And Grady gets slashed,
and the nails just protrude from Jesse's fingers. That was really creepy, too.
That was good. Now, ultimately, Freddy, he's at the pool party, uninvited. Now, again,
existing in the real world.
This
he's extant in the real world, contravening whatever conceit has been set up in the first one, which we all bought into. And he can only get you in your dreams.
This will drive, you know, purists of the franchise crazy, because he's now in the real world, killing, slashing,
maiming.
Not even that effectively. He's just sort of like, you know, willy-nilly, just, you know, whoever happens to be in the way of his gloves, it's a little bit of a slash. He's a hilarious character that decides that he's going to be the alpha male, stand up to Freddy, and he's like, he goes, hey man, just calm down, relax, relax, we'll help you. And Freddy goes, I mean, this is before Freddy became the king of one-liners. That started happening in the next one. He goes, help yourself, fucker, and slashes him to death. Now, there is one incredible line in this movie, and that is when... Mainly
iconic,
after that, iconic, where Freddy looks at all the people at the party, they're all huddled and terrified, and he looks and goes, they're all my children now. And that's just incredible.
And the pool turns into a lake of fire, like the Book of Revelations, except in this case it's more like a backyard immolating into some sort of fire, I don't know what, but you know, the fire effects, you can actually, they're quite visible behind Freddy, and you can actually see them very telegraphed as they emerge, but what really is a cool scene is when they actually boil the water of the swimming pool, and you can see the water become topsy-turvy, and all the bikini-clad denizens have just run from it because they're being scalded, which was really actually legitimately creepy.
Well, you know, I will say one thing about this, about not just this movie, but like Freddy and Nightmare in general, and that is that Freddy Krueger is the suburban boogeyman. That's really neat, because I mean, most of the time when we look at horror, we always think of the urban areas, you know, we think of the big city, right?
Whereas your maniacs and whatnot.
Exactly. Whereas Freddy Krueger, it's like it's almost akin to Blue Velvet in the sense that, like, you know, in the safe white picket fence suburbs, you know, the suburbs, exurbs, whatever, you know, everything is hunky dory. But the thing about Freddy is that he is like that deep dark secret that exists in the suburbs. Mm. I mean, he is a suburban boogeyman. I mean, if you look at every Nightmare movie, it always takes place in the suburbs, and that lends a little extra layer of fright to the Nightmare series, because we all know to be afraid of the big bad city, but shit man, we should be safe in the suburbs, right?
True enough. Yeah.
I mean, Mike Myers too is a bit of a suburban boogeyman as well. You know, I think Freddy and much more so embodies us. You can lock your door, you know, and keep out the gun wielding crackhead outside. Mm-hmm. But you know what? You can't keep out Freddy. Mm-hmm. So that makes Freddy terrifying. But this is not the Freddy that everyone knows, the dream killer. This is a weird Freddy who is able to kill in the real world, and that's why a lot of people look at Nightmare on Elm Street 2 as sort of like the bastard child of this this franchise. In many ways, it's
oh, if not an ersatz, a complete dismissible version of Freddy, because there's no way he should be able to kill in the real world.
No, I agree with you, but I mean, that's why I will maintain that this is not a good Nightmare on Elm Street movie. Mm-hmm. Could be the worst of the bunch. However, it's not.
It's not
a terrible 80s slasher. There's controversy that is going on to this day regarding the homoerotic subtext. Whereas the screener David Chasky for many, many, many years denied the fact that, you know, he put that in intentionally, and only now he's owning up to it. The actor they cast, Mark Patton, is an openly gay actor who at the time was in the closet, but he felt that he was almost railroaded, and when they cast him in this movie, they kept making him more and more and more homosexual. Shoulder claims that he was completely oblivious of anything homoerotic in this movie, which either renders the guy completely stupid or completely naive, because even the associate producer of this movie says, when you watch it, it's shockingly homoerotic. Interestingly enough, Patton, after this movie, he just disappeared from Hollywood. He felt this movie destroyed his career. It took him a long time to embrace it. He is now slowly embracing his part of the Elm Street legacy. He was in the documentary Never Sleep Again, The Elm Street Legacy.
An excellent documentary. And if you have 3 hours to spare to wade through it.
Seven hours, my friend.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. It's 7 hours well spent. But there's going to be an upcoming documentary, Mark Patton, called Scream Queen, My Nightmare in Elm Street. Even New Line executive Jeff Katz called this a Top Gun of franchise horror films, in the sense that it is as gay as... And we're not even talking about the dance that Mark Patton does in his bedroom.
Or as gay as Tom Cruise arguably is. Yeah, but if fair enough. Yeah, the gay set piece where he dons a pair of incredibly 80s spectacles and prances around in his bedroom.
And he's Samantha Fox's touch.
Yes. And he's caught by his girlfriend and mother. And
well, here I was saying, we're not even going to talk about it. We're not going to talk about it. So, okay. And that scene apparently was popular in, you know, these villages in New York for many years. Mm-hmm. We played in, you know, the gay clubs. You know, it's a really, really bizarre beast, this movie. It was a success. The fact is that this movie was made shockingly low budget by today's standards, $2.2 million, and it grossed $30 million domestically. As big a hit as it was domestically, it was a much bigger hit in Europe because they actually picked up on that text, you know, and they loved the sort of kinky sexuality of it all.
True enough.
But the producer of the film realized, hey man, this is not the direction we want to go to. They totally righted the course with Nightmare on Elm Street Part 3, The Dream Warriors,
yeah.
Which is fucking awesome. Mm-hmm. Craven actually worked on that a bit. He worked on the original script, although they did sort of modify his script. That one was directed by Chuck Russell. Shoulder had nothing to do with it. I would say that's probably the second best in the series, for sure. But this one remains a very unique curio in the Nightmare legacy. Is it a good Nightmare on Elm Street movie? No, it's not. But it's not a terrible movie. It's not scary. The first movie was damn scary. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the first movie played on so many themes that we talked about in our Nightmare podcast of safety, lack thereof, etc.
Yeah. Inability to be able to count on parental figures and law enforcement as sources of security.
The sins of the father being visited on the child, that sort of thing. I mean, this movie, it's not scary. It was a cash-in. I mean, they just wanted to keep the Elm Street train rolling. Luckily, they ride the course of the third. Unfortunately, things start going a bit downhill after that. But hey, you know what? It's not terrible, but it's not... It probably is the worst of the Elm Street, not the Elm Street series.
Fair enough.
So what did you learn from Nightmare on Elm Street 2?
I learned that you could inexplicably conscript someone who has nothing but contempt for the first one, and who has nothing, I would argue, but contempt for its fans, who accept the conceit of its forebear of the only time the antagonist can get to you is in your dreams, and he just completely dispenses with that, and that apparently is acceptable. What did you learn?
Well, I mean, what I learned is basically that in the 80s, shit, man, a bad secret began. Freddy Mania was running wild. There was no... I mean, the only person more ubiquitous in the 80s than Freddy Krueger, I would say, was maybe...
Michael Jackson?
Yeah, honestly, Madonna. I mean,
yeah.
Freddy Krueger was everywhere. It's
from
amazing.
One gloved figure to another.
There you go. And it's amazing how a character whose genesis was that of a child molester ended up becoming... Basically,
a
pop
culture touchstone. Yeah,
and he—I mean, he was being sold as talking dolls in Toys R Us. So, bad sequels be damned. It didn't matter. The Freddy juggernaut was a train that would not be stopped, and much like Donald Trump today.
Yeah, and ironically, I would argue that maybe Robert Englund was one of. I would maybe say the Lisa character as well, one of only two good performances in this whole thing. This was beset by just awful performances across the board. And he was one of the few who actually brought it, and brought the scares, and brought the tension, and brought the horror. Otherwise, the rest of it was just kind of lackluster.
Now, amazingly enough, in the entire 90-minute running time of this movie, Freddy's only in it for 13 minutes.
Yeah.
But yet, such is the looming presence of Robert Englund that, you know...
Yeah, and he brought, as we talked about in the last podcast, the oral horrors as well as the visual way of...
He would introduce himself orally as opposed to...
Nails upon chalkboard or...
In this case, he was scraping along the railing and so on.
Yeah, and which is inherently frightening. And as far as star rating, yeah, again, you know,
it's a tough one because as far as nightmares go, and as far, unfortunately, a sequel. This is a clear case of diminishing returns. I mean, Nightmare 1 was incredible. 2 was fairly bad. 3 was incredible, and then every subsequent sequel got worse and worse.
Debased the legacy. Yeah.
Although New Nightmare was a bit of a different beast entirely, but I would say that this still would remain the worst of the bunch. And as far as the nightmare goes, I would give it a 1.5. But if you divorce it from the franchise,
yeah,
it's
2.5.
It's a 2.5 movie, and it's an interesting curiosity now because of the whole
revisiting it with under a different lens, for sure.
And it's sort of sad that, I mean, this movie kind of torpedoed Mark Patton's career in Hollywood, because he was charismatic, but it was just a different time back then. And, you know, I'm really looking forward to seeing Patton's documentary and seeing his take on this whole thing, because he still feels like he was shoulder and Shaskin totally railroaded this poor kid. So that'll be something interesting, hopefully within the next... Hey, man, I'd love to interview Mark Patton. I'd love to, you know, chat with him and see what he...
Hopefully we'll be able to bring that to our listeners soon.
Yeah, so you're still ringing? You're agreeing with me?
Yeah, 2.5, if it wasn't part of the Nightmare franchise, if you will, 1.5. Because it clearly is. Still, as part of the series, you can't avoid it. It's a bridge to the third. It has some legit scares, for sure legit scares, even though as a whole it doesn't cohesively come together still. And for more, check out our website, www.reallyawfulmovies.com. Send us an email, for sure, reallyawfulmovies@gmail.com. Let us know what your favorite nightmare film is. If it's not one, we probably will dismiss you outright. But maybe we can be convinced. Yeah, three as well. Yeah, maybe we can be convinced. And we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.